C2M. Number 4B.
Then I come to a next subtone spirit that is different. The question in soul, how does this unity of interest express itself, is answered in spirit through association of pure qualities. So you can see in mind it was more or less the association with higher thoughts, with thinkers that have ideals, that have higher concepts and higher motives. Now, these motives must be kept pure, and we have to see that we don't mingle them. Can you see, every time we come to the subtone of spirit, it is a question to keep pure what we have gained in mind. So little by little we come into the rhythm again of the subtones, that it says in mind, it has all to do with a higher way of thinking. And then in spirit, now that higher way of thinking has to be kept pure and not mixed up again with lower tendencies. So here it says ill-arranged notes, if they are ill-arranged, produce discord. Tones of the human mind may be different, but they should be concordant in order to blend properly. Here you have again blending properly, that soul, the unity of interest. And she says, though the human mind has different qualities, they can unite into a concordance, into harmony, in order to blend properly. So unselfish ambition, noble life motives and purity, these constituents of thought, now you give to the thought of mind the pure quality, the spiritual qualities. So though mingling, when positive tones mingle, they constitute individually and collectively true happiness, strength and permanence. That's the tone of spirit. How do we make concord and how do we make discord? That's a side note, concord and discord. It is in our hand to define if our life is happy or not happy. Here it is shown, if we unite, if we have the same interest as the other, namely in an elevating mind and keep that pure, then all those different ideas, those different thoughts, those different concepts can blend together and constitute really a harmony. And this individually and collectively. So that it shows that it is a mankind is individual and collective. Then we come to the tone of soul as soul, and again we have a very different aspect. Naturally, here in soul as soul, we get, so to say, the core of the subject. The answer to the question, how does this unity of interest express itself, is answered in the subtone as soul, namely through moral freedom, which cannot be abused or limited by selfishness. So the counterfeit of the unity of interest is selfishness, where everybody has an interest of its own. If we can be selfless, then we feel the freedom of soul. This is brought out under the side note, mutual freedom. So you get again mutual as the tone of the soul subject, and it's mutual freedom, so that we are, though we unite with one common interest, we still are free. That uniting with qualities doesn't make us to be servants, doesn't lay us into chains. We are still free in that soul. So there is moral freedom in soul. So we may have the same fundamental interest, we still are free. Never contract the horizon of a worthy outlook by the selfish exaction of all another's time and thoughts. So this is an advice that shows and covers a negative sense, that always wants in a relationship contract the horizon of a worthy outlook, that always wants to bind back the other one by a selfish exaction of all another's time and thought. Taking possession of somebody else's time, especially of somebody else's thought, and bind it to a selfish situation. With additional choice, benevolence should grow more diffusive. So we have a nice tone of benevolence that should grow more diffusive. The narrowness, now again the counterfeit of the limitlessness of soul, is now the narrowness and jealousy, which would confine a wife or a husband forever within four walls, will not promote the sweet interchange of confidence and love. But on the up to this point, we see here, this is again robbing, so to say, the moral freedom of each one by narrowing down the other's freedom, the narrowness, the jealousy, which would confine a wife or a husband forever within four walls. That's all the counterfeit of the unlimited freedom. That would really be a danger to the happiness of a relationship. But on the other hand, now the other extreme would be a wandering desire for incessant amusement outside the home circle is a poor augury for the happiness of wedlock. So she has also to deal with wild freedom, so that there is not on one side the tendency to limit freedom, and then on the other side the tendency towards wild freedom. So that's why she said there is moral freedom in soul. We get the balanced sense in soul when we see that if our interchange of interest is not selfish. The moment it is selfish, either by binding the other one to boundaries or giving ourselves wild freedom, that is negative. Home, she says, is the dearest spot on earth, and it should be the center, though not the boundary, of the affection. Again, repeating, so to say, that we should not consider the home, so to say, as a boundary, and limiting ourselves just to the four walls, and just first have always the question, does it give us something? So that selfish expectation is constantly here, that always is an egotistic sense. Does it help us? What does it give us? Where do I come into the picture? So that the I becomes the center instead of freedom in soul becomes the center. If we go further to principle, we see another aspect of that mutuality. We have put it here like this, that this unity of interest expresses itself as principle through the obligations of solicitude, through the obligation of mutuality. And you hear in obligation a tone of principle, namely of obedience, to have to stick to it. So through the obligation of solicitude, mutual attention and approbation. A great sense of obligation for mutuality. That mutuality should be the subject and not selfishness, and that it is even an obligation that we see that all have their interests properly shared and distributed in a relationship. The text here is quite prosaic and poetic, said the peasant bride to her lover. Now you come to the relationship of the bride and the lover. Two eat no more together than they eat separately. This is a hint that a wife ought not to court vulgar extravagances or stupid ease because another supplies her wants. So it's again a touch of not being selfish and say, well, the other can care for me, that everybody cares for each other and not feels that the other one is here just to care for oneself. Wealth may obviate the necessity for toil or the chance for ill nature in the marriage relationship. But nothing can abolish the cares of marriage. Yes, so often with money you can iron out so many things that you couldn't iron out without money. So that is not the way to do it. That what did she say? Wealth, yeah, may not really obviate necessity for toil. That should not be replace really the cares for marriage. We shouldn't take wealth and iron out everything with money and not care for the mutual relationship of marriage. This is a problem that is so uppermost today in the world that everything that young people do can be ironed out with money and can try to be satisfied with money, giving money and giving pocket money and so on, and not care for the relationship that really should be there between parents and children. And then we blame the children if they are not well educated, if they are then afterwards not behaving themselves as they should. She that is married careth. So we have a great sense here in soul as principle that we have obligation, that we have to care, that mutuality is an obligation, and that we should not try to sidestep it through wealth. She that is married careth how she may please her husband, says the Bible. And this is the pleasantest thing to do. Matrimony should never be entered into without the full recognition of its enduring obligation on both sides. Here you have again on both sides that obligation should be kept. It's mutual. Not only one should care for the other, but both should care for each other. There should be the most tender solicitude for each other's happiness. Can you see again the mutuality? That one doesn't say, well, the main thing is that I'm happy, that everything is fine for me. I don't care about the other one. He can care for himself. This is not mutual care. But actually, only then our universe becomes bigger and bigger if our interest is the same interest as the others, and therefore we care for the interest of the others. Then we take part of the bigger field of relationship, and therefore we feel enriched, and feel enriched life, and have a better human relationship truth. So there should be the most tender solicitude for each other's happiness, and mutual attention, again you get the mutuality, a mutual attention and approbation should wait on all the years of married life, again showing here soul as principle that says, well, there is mutuality of interest, but that should not be left to chance, that it must be an obligation, and you have to care for that relationship. We come to life as the last subtone, and again we see that the question, how does this unity of interest express itself, is answered as life, namely through a maintenance and furtherance of the individuality of each partner. This is a beautiful point, naturally, here, that we should see that we can only have mutuality of interest, that we can only further a real relationship when we acknowledge the individuality of the other partner, acknowledge that he has an other individuality than we. He may have a different mission than we. He may have different abilities than we. His faculties may be different than we. But that we accept that individuality, but not only accept it, but also sustain and maintain it, so that we express fatherhood towards the other individuality. Then we can broaden out our individuality, then we take part in the other individuality and therefore have a much bigger sense of manhood. Again, you can hear that tone of mutuality right away, namely mutual compromises. So if we come back to compromise, we'll often maintain a compact which might otherwise become unbearable. Again, we have compromise, which is not absolute. So we see this chapter is not a chapter that shows man in the absolute sense, but actually working out his humanity until he can get hold of his divinity. So sometimes there is better to have a compromise and make things not so bad as if there would be no compromise. So we choose the lesser evil of two evils. Man should not be required to participate in all the annoyances and cares of domestic economy, nor should woman be expected to understand political economy. Now, we would never accept that today. Today it is quite different. Men take really care in the household and look after the babies and put on the swaddling clothes and so on of the baby. 50 years ago, 100 years ago, no man would have done that. Today it's absolutely natural. 100 years ago, yes, there was no equal right for women, no political right for women. Today they have equal rights. Can you see that this chapter is a chapter that shows how the transition must go on? That what was right 100 years ago may no more be right today. That the laws that were right 100 years ago in the human field are no more right today in the human field. That there must be a development and an unfoldment, and that unfoldment must go on. And Mrs. Eddy, so to say, opened up with this chapter the freedom to go on. At her time, this was the right thing to do. At our time, 100 years ago, we would no more share her view. Quite to the contrary, we would fight for the equality of women. Today, as never before, I think in all the modern industrial states, you have a great drive to bring in laws and legislation that give to men and women the same rights politically, but also the same rights economically, that both men and women for the same work have the same wages, which still has not been acknowledged today, we must say, to our shame, but it's on the way. And in another 10, 20 years, this will be accepted. And so it is in regard to the family law, the laws for divorce and the treatment of men and women after divorce. All this will be better than 100 years ago. So we come to certain statements in this chapter, as we see, that we feel, yes, they are not no more reflecting the advancing age, and therefore they are not wrong, but they depict really the developing phases of what Mrs. Eddy wants to show in the textbook. She wants to show that she starts out with the propagation of human species up to the point that says that finally this will cease and men will be acknowledged as the Son of God, as the God's creation. So, can we see that all these statements within this chapter are statements for the transition, for a transitionary stage, indicating that it is the principle of marriage that we can change, really, the human level, but always to the best, that the concession that has been made were at that time for the best. Perhaps it was for the best in earlier times that men did not participate in the annoyances of the household, and the women did not have the rights for political elections and so on. I don't know, we are today in such a different era that it seems to us already antiquated, obsolete, and that we live already nearer to the end, where men and women are absolutely equal. Not only that, but where we begin to see they are not mortals, that they are immortals. So, but the point is that what she says is still true, namely that she said, if there are different fields of obligations, if there are different fields of abilities and faculties, individual faculties and abilities, fulfilling the different demands of their united spheres, this is the point she wants to bring out, that though they are different, that we can see that they must constitute a united sphere. So even if today we give we should have equal rights and equal earnings and equality of the two sexes, there is still a united sphere within which we work, within which we live, and this is the point she wants to bring out, that these different fields must conjoin together and unite the spheres, so that also all the different departments of life should be, so to say, wedded into each other, that they constitute one consistent, coherent network of life, and not that every department of life goes its own way and is scattered into the wind. So again we see, though at that time the different fields were very different from ours, still at that time the point was that they must have a united sphere, just as today it's true too. So that their sympathy should blend in sweet confidence and cheer, each partner sustaining the other, even if everyone has its own individuality and works out its own individuality, still there should be that one supports and sustains the other individuality. That remains. This is a principle in it. Thus hallowing the union of interest and affections, in which the heart finds peace and home. It's nice to see at the moment we have competition, which is the very opposite of united sphere. We have competition where each individuality goes against the other individuality, that this is not a united sphere. So we have nothing that is a roof category of these different individualities, and therefore we will never find peace and a home and a restful home, or a restful society, or a peaceful business, or a peaceful companionship, or whatever it is. So the idea behind this is very deep. She goes further, still in the same vein, tender words and unselfish care, unselfish, a counterfeit of soul, in what promotes the welfare and happiness of your wife will prove more salutary in prolonging her health and smiles than stolid indifference. Stolid indifference, a counterfeit of mutual interest, of supporting each other's individuality. Can you see? Or jealousy. Husbands, Hear this and remember how slight a word or deed may renew the old trysting times. Again, it's another example of how to give to the other really interest for what they do, for their individuality, support their individuality, maintain their individuality, promote their individuality, promote their abilities, sustain them, and provide for those faculties. After marriage, it is too late to grumble over incompatibility of disposition. See, incompatibility of disposition, again, the counterfeit of unity of interest, of unity of qualities. A mutual understanding, again you have mutuality, should exist before this union and continue ever after, for deception is fatal to happiness. Meaning more or less, think first before you marry if those faculties, that individualities of the partnership, of the partners really go together, if they really blend properly, if they are both in the same line, namely all united with the divine quality, or if there is incompatibility of disposition. So this is the whole tone of soul, and we have seen that whole tone of soul is constantly interested that there is only an improvement of mankind, an improvement of the human nature and of the races and civilization, if we begin to lose our selfishness, where we constantly first think about ourselves and don't care about the other, that we have that sense that first I must save myself before I save the other one. If that is overcome, that selfishness, and we begin to see that we are one mankind, one humankind, one brotherhood of men, then we see that our good lies in the good of the other. Then we try to support everything that is good in the other, so that our interests converge, that they are the same, and therefore bring out something much bigger, because then I live also in the individuality of the other. If I support and maintain and provide the other individuality, then I live in their work too, in their efforts too, and in their success too. And so it broadens out the individual to the collective. Yeah. That's so.